Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, is Ethan Sachs. Ethan, we are here for Chapter 2 of the Paternity Chronicles. It is good to see you again.
Good to see you as well, my friend. So much time has passed, and I think now is a good time to let our listeners know that since this is going so well, we are going to now be releasing daily podcasts.
Oh my God, no.
Correct? No?
Definitely not.
Yeah, we're here December 27th, and we're sending off Bro in classic Lords of Limited fashion with our 50 Takes in 50 Minutes episode. I've gotten a lot of feedback in the past year about our 50 Takes episodes, and they're sort of just a happy accident of like, we started doing this for OG Dominaria for our 50th episode, and then I think skipped a set and then decided, hey, this is actually a pretty good way to summarize the formats. And then also bonus is that there's such good ways for folks to be able to come back. It's like, oh, I haven't played Streets in a few months, and now it's like my, you know, LGS's RCQ, and what do I do? And so they go and listen to the 50 takes and they do well, or it's a flashback draft online or a flashback draft at their LGS. And so I love to hear that it's helpful for folks as a retrospective, you know?
Well, and there's going to be a Kaldheim Arena Open coming up, right? So you better believe I'm going to be going back and listening to the Kaldheim 50 takes, because that was a complex format and I liked it a lot, but it is not very fresh in my mind right now.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I don't go back and listen because I have, you know, I have the highest tier of Patreon in a way. So I go back and I check the show notes. So I just scour the show notes for all the good information and then get to reap the benefits. So yeah, for sure. That is a sweet perk. So that's what we'll be doing today. Ben, I want to give you an opportunity because you did the bulk of the work here. And then I, you know, took a second pass and judged and you know, just tweaked and consolidated some notes. Do you have any honorable mentions for these 50 takes that you want to get off your chest? Specifically, an item that I cut from the list called Ben's List of Illegal Rares. Do you have any beef you want to take care of here with some cards from Bro?
I would love to. So here's my list of illegal rares that was axed from our 50 takes quite maliciously.
Yeah.
Top of the list, Siege Veteran. Why does this cost 3 mana?
It's just Luminarch Aspirant or whatever, right? Like the 2-mana 1/1 that puts counters on stuff, except it's like one more mana, but for limited, it's basically the same. And that card is broken.
Yes, it's totally absurd. Number 2 on the list, Titania's Command. Mm-hmm. Why is this 12-12 plus power and toughness for 6 mana? It is totally unnecessary to make 2 8-8s and then also, or I guess, 2 4-4s. I'm inflating in my mind what the card actually did. But man, it was so hard to beat. I think I beat Titania's Command once, all format, and conceded many times when it was cast.
Card is very upsetting.
Gix's Command. Why does this need to be a board wipe plus a benefit to you? Or if the board doesn't need to be wiped, why not make it bring back 2 creatures? Like, it's so versatilely good.
Yeah, and if you want to see someone have Siege Veteran, Titania's Command, and Gix's Command in one deck together, be on the lookout for Rares versus Reanimator, a Lords of Limited showdown on the Channel Fireball YouTube.
That was a good match of Magic the Gathering.
Sure was. All right, continue, sir.
There's so many other cards that just snowball or end the game. Skystrike Officer, why does this need to snowball so hard on 3 mana? Tyrant of Care Ridges, we need more flying dragon flame tongue Kabus in the world. Wormcoil Engine, colorless 6/6, Death Touch, Lifelink. You want to kill it? Oh, wait, I'll take 2 more creatures with those abilities, please. Portal to Phyrexia, you had a board? Oh, wait, no, you didn't. Oof, I hate the rares. I just started looking down the 17 lands list, and then my blood pressure got so high, I stopped after Portal to Phyrexia. There were like about 20 other cards I wanted to list, and then I realized, oh, this is terrible. So thank you for letting me get that off my chest. That was a lot of pent-up anger.
the decibel and the pitch level of your voice slowly began to escalate as you got up the list. You had me. I was in your corner until you got to Portal to Phyrexia. It's a 9 mana mythic. How mad can you be, you know?
But the game's done. I mean, yeah, it's sure. Portal's fine. But the game is just over when your opponent casts it, unless you had tokens.
So here, it's very funny, and I know we're going down the rabbit hole just a little bit here. I promise we'll get back on rails, we'll do our housekeeping, we'll get to the 50 takes. But as you are enjoying yourself, as I watched you on stream yesterday, in the Vintage Cube that you're doing, how do you rationalize the part of Vintage Cube that is all zero-sum fun, like, you have no permanence, I have all the permanence. But something like Portal to Phyrexia in a regular limited format bothers you. Like, is it just you know what you're signing up for when you draft Vintage Cube?
Well, and I always have the opportunity to draft an insane deck in Vintage Cube. Like, the playing field is level because every pack is filled with busted cards.
Okay.
My gripe with Bro is when I do a draft and my draft ends and I drafted a tight little two-color deck and have no rares but have some good uncommons and some good first pick commons, and then I lose to decks with these rares in them, and I never had the opportunity to pick them. Like I told you last week, my whole thing with drafting is I want to have a better deck at the end of the draft so that my gameplay can be sloppy. And I think in formats that have tons of great rares like this, I have less of an advantage in general at the end of drafts.
Look at you go, just like training for reality competition television by saying last week to an episode we recorded 24 hours ago.
I mean, I'm a professional. What can I say?
Just a professional. Absolutely astounding. Okay, so a couple housekeeping things before we send Bro off in Lords Limited fashion and Ben can shut the door on this nightmare of a format for him. First things first, let's talk about the Patreon page. Patreon.com/Lords of Limited is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. The show, of course, will always be free, but we got some sweet perks along the way. You get access to the Lords of Limited Discord. If you're in the middle of the Arena Decathlon and you're like, oh man, what deck should I be playing? I want to be talking to a like-minded group of limited individuals and try and spike these constructed events. The Lords Limited Discord is for you. And Phyrexia All is One is just around the corner. Another great time to get in on the Lords Limited Discord. As you move up the reward tiers, you get access to the show notes in advance of the episode, get access to the show a day early. So that's a sweet perk. And all the way up the reward tiers, you get access to monthly coaching sessions with me or Ben. So if any and all of that sounds of interest to you, check out our Patreon page. No patrons to shout out this week because we are in the midst of the Paternity Chronicles. But from the bottom of my heart, while I am taking these sleepless nights and days with a crying baby, thank you, thank you, thank you for your support.
Yeah, we cannot say thank you enough. Show is also brought to you by TCG Player, tcgplayer.com. Best place to go for anything and everything you need Magic related on the internet, whether that's getting some sealed product or maybe signing up for a TCG Player subscription, $6.99 a month, which will get you free shipping and tracking, some extra bonus bucks, as well as access to all of the backlog of CFB Pro articles. I'm sure there will be tons of sweet new content coming out in January and February leading up to Phyrexia All Will Be One. So if you want to get in on that TCG Player subscription or purchase some sealed product on the website, please use our affiliate link so that they know that we sent you over there. There's two ways to get there. You can go to lordslimited.com/TCG Player. That will redirect you automatically to our affiliate link. Or you can check out our website, lordslimited.com. There's a bunch of sweet stuff there. There's tier lists. There's links to our merch, other sweet stuff. And you can click on the support tab. And then there's also a link to the TCG Player affiliate link there as well.
Boom. I know this will be a thing of the distant past when this episode is released, but I am shockingly hyped for the 48-hour Cube for Charity event happening on Twitch right now. It's a Team J-Bro versus Team Jim Davis with a 4v4 team on a Cube trophy hunt for the Vintage Cube. And I never like think I'm going to care about it, but all of a sudden it comes around. This happens every year, comes around, and I'm just like glued to my Twitch screen watching as many of those streamers as I can.
I am as well. I fell asleep watching Caleb stream last night.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, just like anytime there's just the slightest inkling of stakes or limited, I'm just like, ooh, I'm interested. All right, let's get to it. 50 Brothers War takes in 50 minutes, Ben. I'm going to start the clock. You want to kick us off in 3, 2, 1, let's go.
Number one, Bro was the fastest format we've had in a long time. Fast enough that we don't like to talk about speed, and I don't think you could talk about Bro without talking about the speed of the format.
So, confession here, a little behind the scenes. I almost wrote a like addendum bullet point and wrote, was it in our show notes? So talk to me about this, because I do think there is a little bit of best of one versus best of three happening here. But I know you dip your toe plenty into best of three as well during this format. So just talk to me about what you mean by it being the fastest format, because a lot of times, you know, in recent sets, we're just like, speed isn't important to talk about because every limited set you have to get on board. Your curve is important. Two drops are important, etc. So what makes this format specifically unique in that way?
It's hard to put my finger on, honestly, other than that I can tell you with great certainty, anytime I tried to dirtle without respecting getting on board, I just insta-lost to the worst, clunkiest cards with power and toughness. I mean, I don't know if it was because there's such a high density of 3-1s that were attacking you early, easily, or just cards with stats for under-costed mana or unearth, like maybe made you have a turn less. You know, people could unearth their Scrapwork Cohorts or their Mishra's Juggernauts and kind of get you on turn five, turn six. But it felt very fast to me, and I couldn't quite put my finger on why that is. I guess removal's good too, so people always had removal to remove your blockers if you were behind a step. I don't know. I wish I had a better answer for you than that.
No, that was a good enough answer for me, and I think I'll throw in one other thing. I do think that the colorless nature of a lot of the Unearth cards, as we'll get to a little later, just allowed people who were ahead of the curve to understand that they could have a good curve in any draft. You know, you didn't have to worry as much about, oh, is this color going to be open? Is this color pair open? Can I get two drops? Like, if you think about Streets of New Capenna, as we just last week, wink, wink, did our retrospective on the year, you know, thinking about Streets, the rules of engagement there, and the two color two drops that were at Common, I think the colorless two drops at Common here, the colorless ways to get on board, really added to that impact as well.
Yes, for sure.
Number two, Bro was not Power Stones the format as we initially assumed during preview season. You know, it's kind of savage to give the founder of Rectangle Theory this point, but I must agree with you. They were big players, but not the whole picture. And I would say, like, the sort of if-then statement that we thought existed of, like, if Power Stones, then big monsters. It was if Power Stones, but it wasn't then big monsters. It was then Mana Sinks, then Unearth or whatever, you know, like it, Power Stones and only some ways to make Power Stones, I would say, were impactful.
Right. But they were still very good. I mean, the cards that were good that made Power Stones were great because you could use, you know, that stuff on paying for Unearth costs or just literal Rectangle Theory, like as pieces of cardboard to sacrifice to other things for very good effects. It was important to have disposable things on the battlefield for so many of the premium cards.
For sure.
Number three, if it was not Power Stones the format, it was Unearth the format. Unearth was the defining mechanic of Bro.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I just missed it in preview season in the Crash Course. I just was like, oh, cool, Unearth is back. And I hadn't ever played with it outside of Cube. You know, I must have been in my sort of blind spot in my Magic history of when it came out in like regular limited formats. So I hadn't played with it in a regular set before. I was like, cool, it's back. But it was just so much and took me a few weeks before I was like, oh, this is what Bro is all about, you know?
Yeah, for me, this also went a week or two. I do think we were on all of those cards like Scrapwork Cohort or Combat Courier being good. I remember talking about those cards being overperformers in our first episode that we recorded after playing with the cards. But I still don't think we had internalized that they were the best cards in the format.
And that they were colorless.
Right. Yes, that as well.
Yeah. Number four, removal was the best it has been since we started the podcast. Another behind the scenes point for you folks. I think I consolidated about five bullet points about removal into two in the show notes here. So this is one of them. And that just goes to show how prevalent this was for us, how important removal was. And as we'll talk about later, even the sort of, you know, offshoot or clunkier looking removal spells that we often see in various colors were good. I mean, what did you say last week? You were like, I love casting Epic Confrontation. What a far cry from some green fight or bite spells we've seen in the past where you've, like, you know, gone on a soapbox about them being unplayable.
Yeah, that's funny. Normally, I do hate the green fight spell with a burning passion. Epic Confrontation was my jam in this format. What can I say? I played green way too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was good. I mean, green had two fight spells, not bite spells, and they were both pretty darn good. And I think, you know, as you go all the way down the list of like, well, what's like the clunkiest, least playable removal spell I'd want to play? And you'd still probably put in your deck. I talked about putting Goblin Firebomb in multiple decks in this format just because I was like, need a way to interact, got some Power Stones, whatever. This is a 5-mana removal spell in my deck. And sometimes you just got to do it. So I definitely think that removal was so, so important. I mean, not only for removing, you know, cheap threats, so if you were trying to go late with something like Disfigure, but for just being able to have answers to those game-breaking bombs or to disrupt engines.
Completely agree. And I also think, despite how important removal was, it's interesting to note that the best cards to pick early were still cards like, you know, Scrapwork Mutt and company. The best creatures still were higher picks than removal, even though removal was so important.
Because of how well those creatures stacked up against removal, right? You never wanted to fire off Excavation Explosion on a Scrapwork Mutt or a Scrapwork Cohort. You're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
Like, that's just coming back for more later.
Right. You just get two for one. Yeah. Number five, despite having numerous bombs, the retro artifacts were definitely a net positive for the format.
I cannot believe I don't have to fight you on this point.
No, they're definitely, this is not even close for me. They're definitely good. I mean, Wormcoil Engines, a bit egregious. Precursor Golems, a bit egregious. But all in all, the retro artifacts definitely made the format way more fun. Like, they did so many things to enable getting on board early, having disposable artifacts. They did cool things with each other. They did cool things with some of the weirder rares that were actually in Bro. I just think this, or the Mystical Archive from Strixhaven, almost anytime they do something like this, is just going to add variety and depth to the drafts in the format. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm glad you mentioned Precursor Golem, so I get to get on my soapbox just a little bit for a second, which is that I cannot tell you how many times someone in Twitch chat would be like, do we have anything in our deck that like makes Precursor Golem good? I'm like, no, I'm sorry, I don't have Gaia's Gift in my deck. I just have a 5-mana 9/9 over 3 cards. Like, it's just good. You don't need to combo with it. People be like, should we play Taunos Tinkering to go with Precursor Golem? Like, absolutely not. Can I just play my 5-mana 9/9 that's colorless? Totally agree. Love this. Love the Mystical Archive. And please do not like start trying to do this for every set. So nice to just have it like once every 2 years as a really cool limited treat, I think.
Yes, agree with that for sure.
Number six, Bro was definitely a board presence people format that rewarded being proactive. I mean, this goes back to the fastest format we've had in a long time, but like, I mean, boy, howdy. This format will not only teach you about deck building, but it will teach you about getting on board early and often.
Yeah, and I think somehow I managed to lose this along the way towards the end of the format. You know, after we stopped for the Arena Open and doing a little cube and then coming back, I knew it was a rule, but I don't think I knew how important it was, or I'd forgotten how important it was, or I was trying to go level two, when like the level to be on that's the best is still just level one. Like, just getting on board is still better than trying to, you know, play black green life gain with a bunch of commons and uncommons, that sort of thing. So yeah, definitely get on board early and often.
For sure.
Number seven, almost all of the Unearthed cards were colorless if you drafted your deck appropriately.
Amen. I think I would put 10 of the 12 as colorless. I'd leave Heavyweight Demolisher and Yoshin Frontliner. Is that the one drop?
Yes.
I'd leave those as not quite colorless, but the other 10 for sure is just like, as the more you shift your mindset to these are actually colorless cards, and then somewhere along the way, you'll pick up a way to fix for them, whether it's an Evolving Wilds, fetching a mountain for a couple mutts, whatever, a couple mutts and a Mishra's research desk. But like, just being able to shift that mindset and delay your decision and just put those cards in as many decks as possible ups your win rate.
Preach.
Number eight. Fixing was scarce in the format, and yet such an important piece of like making these quote unquote colorless Unearthed cards splashable, you know?
Yeah. So we had Sentinel Stalwart as the green 1/1 that could tap an artifact or creature along with it to make a mana of any color. You had Evolving Wilds to go fetch up a basic and Energy Refractor to filter mana through. That was the 2-mana artifact that ETB drew a card and let you pay 2 mana to make 1 mana of any color. And I think, honestly, all three of these were excellent. I think I would put Evolving Wilds 1, Energy Refractor 2, Sentinel Stalwart 3. Is it blasphemy to put Sentinel Stalwart 3rd on this list?
I think it's blasphemy to put Energy Refractor 2nd on this list because, number 9, speaking of, the Golden Egg Award goes to Energy Refractor.
Da, da, da. Love that card.
We've teased this quite a bit. But yeah, I still think I'm on Energy Refractor over Wilds. And to go back to the previous point, no, I don't think it's blasphemy to put Stalwart third there just because colorless, baby. I mean, I think you want to, you know, the more you get to lean into that colorless nature of the format, the more you get to delay the decision. And not that that's correct for every single draft you do, but having that as a tool in your toolbox is really important. But yeah, Energy Refractor does it all. You want to fix your mana for Unearthed cards? Check. You want to draw an extra card a turn if you're in that blue-black deck or have some synergy pieces for that? Check. You want a disposable artifact on the battlefield to sacrifice? Check. You've got a Yoshin Dissident and you want an artifact to enter the battlefield and replace itself? Check. What can't this card do?
It really is an awesome glue card. Very, very, very good. I did experiment a lot with Sentinel Stalwart towards the end of the format and got a little lost in the sauce. And I kind of landed on that you still wanted to try to wheel Sentinel Stalwarts. I think you got kind of punished when you were taking them highly over other cards that were playable.
I think so. And it was a little push-pull because that was like one of the last gasps of, you know, I'd say like the meta shift, sort of similar to when Jasper Sentinel was really discovered and preached to the masses during Kaldheim. I think it started to, a card that you started to feel like you could wheel was a card that people were like, ooh, I'm first picking that. It's like, well, part of the reason this card is so good is because you can get it late.
For sure.
Number 10, the color power rankings for this format are red, greater than black, greater than white, greater than green, greater than blue.
We had no discussion on this point. Are you not fighting back at all?
I'm not fighting back. I still, for me, feel like it's a Jund format, but I don't think that means that white can't be ahead of green.
Yeah, I just felt more and more towards the end of the format. I do think green is my most drafted color, which is a little embarrassing. Like if you looked at my top commons, but I just felt more and more as the format went on that green didn't play great with artifacts unless you paired it with white.
Interesting. Yeah, I did not feel that way, but maybe that was just because I was taking Mask of the Jade Crafter so absurdly high.
Oh, I took that card absurdly high as well. That card's a house.
Yeah, an absolute house. But I'm into this, and I think white deserves its day in the sun there, and we'll talk about white a little later as well, just in terms of what it provided, especially at common in this format as a failsafe.
Well, and I also think blue, I think initially was way behind in the power rankings. And I think stuff like Falaji Archaeologist being good and actually a card and all the unearthed cards essentially being colorless, I think pulled blue up in the power rankings because you could play blue and still play all the good unearthed cards. And then you still had like blue's top two or three commons that did play well with all those unearthed things as well. So blue definitely moved up as far as my estimation of it the most over the course of the format, I think.
We have this color power rankings. We don't have any, there's no like six greater than signs between any colors. And you would have done that had you felt that. Like, I'm happy with any color in this format, and I'm happy with almost any color pair in this format. Like, even green-blue, I hope that I would get into for the right reasons, or would be there for like some busted artifacts to ramp into or whatever, be doing some like crazy self-mill stuff with like Blanchwood Prowler, Archaeologist, and the three-mana spell in green that like bins five cards and then you pick one. So I think that like you could do anything largely in this format, but I would say that's largely because like ahead of all five of these colors is the letter C for colorless.
Love it.
All right, let's take a quick ad break and we'll be back with the rest of the list.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Athletic Greens.
This is a product that I've started using every day to improve my energy and immune system. I take it first thing in the morning, and even though it looks like a green smoothie, it tastes like a vanilla protein shake.
So what is this stuff?
It's as easy as taking a multivitamin, Ben. One scoop of AG1 shaken with water, and you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day.
This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, and focus.
AG1 contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything, while still tasting pretty good.
With every purchase, Athletic Greens donates to organizations helping to get nutritious food to kids in need, including No Kid Hungry here in the U.S.
AG1 is a small micro habit with big benefits. It's one thing you can do every single day to take great care of yourself.
Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health.
To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/LOL.
Again, that is athleticgreens.com/LOL to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
And now, back to the show.
Number 11, Prototype looked like a really cool mechanic, but it largely fell flat because of the strict rules of engagement with the format.
And removal being so good. I mean, I came in hot. I was like, Russ Goliath, this is it. This is my time to get to experience a Rise of the Eldrazi style format with these big mechs. And you just couldn't spend 10 mana or whatever, 7 mana and 3 power stones to cast a 10 mana 10-10 and have your opponent go, okay, disenchant. You know, like you just didn't have the ability to do that. Removal was so good and so important and so playable, even the like dregs of removal was playable, that you couldn't do a sort of eggs basket style archetype.
Yeah, completely agree. And honestly, kind of a bummer that Prototype fell flat. I think that was the mechanic I was most excited for after Power Stones going into the format. Like, it was Power Stones, Prototype, Unearth was kind of a distant afterthought, and that's just not really how it panned out, which is fine. I mean, happy with the format the way it was, but interesting to see that that was how things shook out.
It was basically like, I'd say Combat Thresher, that's the white double striker at uncommon. That was like basically the only non-rare that I was happy with. Like even Boulder Branch Golem, I was against the masses on that card. Not that I didn't like it, but I found it much closer to filler than something I was like seeking, just because I was like, you don't only have so much room for cards that are that expensive in this format because there's so much to do with your mana, you know?
Ooh, I'm with the people. Love a Boulder Branch Golem.
I know. All right, number 12, Scrapwork Cohort and Scrapwork Mutt were the best commons in the format to pack one, pick one. Sorry, Scrapwork Mutt, you are ineligible for the Golden Egg Award this year.
So where are you at, pack one, pick one, Mutt or Cohort?
Cohort, baby. Led me to my 3-0-6-0 against Team Resources.
I think I'm on Mutt, pack one, pick one.
Say it ain't so. Four rectangles greater than two rectangles.
That is true, but you also get the draw discards. You get to replace some rectangles. It still moves around four rectangles, I think.
That's true.
And it's two mana versus four mana, which mm-hmm. is just so important in the format to get on board. I think Scrapwork Cohort is more powerful, but Mutt getting lower on your curve, pack one, pick one, feels so much nicer to me. I don't think I had quite as sinking of a feeling as when my opponent played turn two Scrapwork Mutt. It's just such an annoying card in the context of the format. And Cohort is like really good and really good at stabilizing you and probably more powerful. But I didn't quite have that same sinking feeling when Scrapwork Cohort came down on the other side of the battlefield.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't feel strongly. I think I'm going to, you know me, I'm a big data boy. Got to stick with the data and go with Cohort number one. But both of these cards are the clear pack one, pick one commons of the format.
Number 13, the cycle of self-mill creatures went up in value if you picked Unearth cards aggressively and planned to build your deck around them.
Shout out to, in order, Airlift Chaplain in white, Phalagi Archaeologist in blue, Blanchwood Prowler in green, Ravenous Gigamole in black, and Tomical Scrapsmith in red. These cards are great. And I think, again, part of the reason these cards are great, aside from Chaplain, but even Chaplain goes later than it should, I think, is that these cards go late. Like getting Phalagi Archaeologist on the wheel or like whatever, pick six, pick seven, pick eight, feels so good.
Feels so good. And wild that the white and the blue are better than the black and the green when black and green cared about getting creatures in the yard.
Yeah, right, for sure.
That theme just fell very flat at the common and uncommon level.
I agree. Number 14, speaking of, Phalagi Archaeologist was the last hidden gem of the format. And we're going to shout this out a little later, spoiler, as the best common in its color. It enabled so many strats. It was Argothian Sprite's Kryptonite. Nothing felt better than your opponent slamming Sprite on turn two and you responding with a Phalagi Archaeologist that drew you a card and was just an 0-3 sitting laughing at the Sprite, you know?
Well, or your opponent slamming a stupid Rock Hunter, the 3-1 with reach.
Oh, yeah.
And then you just play Phalagi Archaeologist and decline to pull something back. Like maybe you bin some Unearthed cards and you make a 1-4. Like that's awesome against your opponent's 3-1.
And it paired super well with all the recursion effects. I didn't quite realize how many ways there were to reanimate or raise dead creatures or artifacts in this format. But the fact that Archaeologist both milled those things and dug you towards your reanimate effects was so sweet.
Yeah, you could do blue-white reanimator. You could do blue-black reanimator. It was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Number 15, Rakdos Sacrifice was the best and most versatile deck in the format. So many flavors.
Yeah, so you had like Blast Runner aggro or just regular aggro. It didn't have to have Blast Runners. And this was where I think, what was it, Gixxion Infiltrator? That's the 2-1 in black. Mm-hmm. This was like a poor person's Goblin Blast Runner. And in aggressive sacrifice shells was totally serviceable.
Yeah, I would say better than serviceable in the best red-black decks.
And then whatever, move to the other end of the spectrum and you have like a grindy value-based, maybe you've got some engines happening with like Transmogrant Altar or, you know, you got Clay Revenant moving around from battlefield to graveyard to hand and more. You're building out a big board and then using Junkyard Genius to finish off your opponent, whatever.
Yeah, and then lastly you had Steel and Sack, and I think this was the worst of the three archetypes, but you had Act of Treason effects plus Sacrifice Outlets to take your opponent's creatures and then sacrifice them for value. There was just so much good red and black removal that you didn't need to do that to get removal.
Right, that was the thing, is like usually the Steel and Sack package is either, you know, in the case of like AFR, it's just so powerful and there's so many free Sack outlets. But the more common reason is that you end the draft and you don't have a lot of ways to interact. You're like, well, I can cobble together these, you know, Sack outlets and steal pieces, and then I can make removal. It's like, how did you end up in red-black without, you know, six removal spells, you know?
Yeah.
Number 16, several commons and multiples led to very specific decks on their own. Shout out to, I would say this is, you know, the triumvirate at common here. We've got Mightstone's Animation in blue.
Goblin Blast Runner in red.
And Warlord's Elite in white. And I think, you know, once you had, honestly, two copies of these, it started to shift your pick orders. You know, your Warlord's Elite, you're like, okay, gotta lower that curve. Now I'm looking for the survivors of Coilus, and now I'm looking for as many like one mana and two mana artifacts. I want the Combat Courier. I want the Yoshin Frontliners, just so I can spend just three mana on this Warlord's Elite and dump it on turn three.
Right, and Goblin Blast Runner, you're picking up those Bitter Reunions aggressively, maybe a little more aggressively than you would. Mightstone's Animation, just artifacts that cantrip, ETB, or make some Power Stones. All three of those things, once you got multiple copies, really wanted you to do what they say on the card.
Mm-hmm.
Number 17, the best colored common of each color. In white, Airlift Chaplain.
In blue, Phalagi Archaeologist.
In black, Overwhelming Remorse.
In red, Excavation Explosion.
In green, Argothian Opportunist.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people out there who might say Sentinel Stalwart.
Ooh, no way.
I don't know. Wait, hold on. No way that that's right, or no way that people would say that.
No way that that's correct. I stand back against those people.
Yeah, I'm with you on Argothian Opportunist. I would take the question mark away and put a firm period at the end there.
Yeah, there's just a long list of highly mediocre green commons that I love. I mean, there's Argothian Opportunist, there's Epic Confrontation, Love Me an Argothian Sprite.
Yeah.
Lots of things going on there.
Number 18, Bitter Reunion might be one of the cleanest designs ever for a Magic card. Sing me a little love song here, Ben.
This is awesome. I feel the same way about Bitter Reunion that I do about Talarian Terror, in that, like, didn't register with me really at all during preview season. And then you play it and you see how well it goes with other cards. And just a small twist on something like Tormenting Voice made it perfect for the format. It was awesome. I loved the design of this card. I love the fact that it had sacrifice synergy with Goblin Blast Runners. The haste was a nice touch. Like, we all looked at this and we're like, okay. But it was so much more than that, you know?
Oh, yeah. This card was phenomenal. And then, like, Goblin Blast Runner into Bitter Reunion into what? Pendragon Strongbowl might have been, or maybe just like
two more Blast Runners on turn three plus sacrifice your thing.
Yeah. Blast Runner into Scrapwork Mutt into Bitter Reunion sack or whatever. Yeah. On turn three was the Holy Trinity in this format. And, you know, I remember maybe it was week two, you were like, oh man, Goblin Blast Runner is kind of the thing. And I was like, have you played Bitter Reunion in that deck yet? And you were like, no. I was like, give that a shot. And then like later that day, you were like, oh man, you were right. Like Bitter Reunion was the truth. Just that innocuous one mana for haste was not innocuous at all.
No. Number 19, ways to make Power Stones at three mana were way better than ways to make Power Stones at four or five mana.
Yeah. Shout out to, again, our folks over at Mystical Dispute. They were talking about Stone Retrieval Unit as being one of the like woeful underperformers of the format. And they're saying, you know, four mana for a 2/3 is just such bad stats. And I'm like, it's not the stats. Like, if this was three mana for a 1/2 that made a Power Stone, I bet it would be way more playable, because making a Power Stone on turn three is so much more impactful than making a Power Stone on turn four.
Yeah. So some others, Coilus Rock, that I actually didn't mind so much. Not that you necessarily cared about the Power Stone, but the 3/3 Flash Flyer was kind of annoying.
It was so easy to play around, though. I cannot tell you how many times I was like, oh, you're passing with five mana up and you're blue. I know what you're doing. And I just like won't attack into this. And then they just sadly play their Flash Flyer. I don't know. I found that card, like, it wasn't embarrassing by any stretch, but solidly filler for me.
Oh, definitely play aroundable. Just racing in the air with a three powered flyer that had flash was annoying. There was a lot of times that my opponents turned the script on who was the beatdown with Coilus Rock against
me. That's a good point. Yeah. And then Phalagi Excavation, I think you and I really wanted this to be a thing, but just sadly was not. And I think that's largely because like Rust Goliath wasn't a thing as well.
Right.
Number 20, Gaia's Gift, greater than, and I would put multiple greater than signs here, Giant Growth. Power creep is real, people. I mean, this, I think we knew, especially coming off of Dominaria United with Take Up the Shield being so good, and Gaia's Gift not having lifelink, we were still like, this is probably enough keywords that this is going to be good enough. And it was much more than good enough.
Yeah, very good. Number 21, the cycle of mono-colored uncommons rarely came together.
But I would say, as an asterisk, very cool that Elsewhere Flask could enable them in any deck. I think mono-red probably the most real with Sardian Cliffstomper. I definitely had mono-red decks with multiple copies of Cliffstomper.
Yeah, I've seen mono-blue with Flow of Knowledge. Have not done it myself, but have seen it. I have done Blanchwood Armor multiple times, and when it gets there, it's great. And when your opponent has removal, it's not.
Well, and is doable because of Gaia's Gift, right? Once you get a Blanchwood Armor or two, then you're just snapping up any Gaia's Gift you see. And so that on turn five, you go armor and then you're protected.
Oh, you have so much patience. Snapping that thing off on three, crossing my fingers and then complaining when I get unlucky.
Of course. Well, that's the Ben Wernie way. Corrupt, I think, was probably the second most popular of these behind Cliffstomper. But I was never a Corrupt believer in the format.
Also not a Corrupt believer. And then lastly, Lay Down Arms. You just kind of played this in your white decks because right. The format was so low to the ground as far as mana value.
Well, and this was one of, like, you didn't feel bad exiling Scrapwork Mutt. Like, otherwise you felt bad targeting removal at these cheap Unearthed cards. But because Lay Down Arms exiled, less bad.
Yep.
Number 22, the official Lords of Limited Gold Uncommon Power Rankings. Is this the first time that almost all of them were good?
I think so. It stood out to me when I was making this list. I was like, ooh, like that one? Ooh, like that one? Yes, yes, yes.
Like all the way down to number 9, I would say. I would say only, and I'll spoil it, only Battery Bearer as number 10, I think, was the one that fell flat.
And I think there's a gap after the top 5.
Okay.
But the other 4, I think, are pretty good as well.
All right, so in a clear first place, Skyfisher Spider.
Love that card. Number 2, Junkyard Genius.
Number 3, Third Path Iconoclast.
Number 4, Yoshin Dissident.
Triples is best for the 3060 against the team resources. Number 5, Yoshin Tactician. This was such a beating.
Such a beating. When your opponent played one into a second one, like turn 4, turn 5, yeah. That happened to me so many times in this format, and creatures just get huge.
Yeah.
Number 6, Arbalest Engineers.
Number 7, Evangel of Synthesis.
Number 8, Falaji Vanguard.
And number 9, Hero of the Dunes with Battery Bearer in the 10th spot.
There you have it, folks. The official list that no debate could be had about, possibly.
I had no debate. You put this in and I said, great, I don't like making lists.
Number 23, if you didn't see good rares and unearthed cards, white was the default color to draft because it was the easiest way to be aggressive at common.
Here's how I know Ben is trying to internalize something for himself, is that this was the other point that came up about 4 different times in his initial pass of the 50 takes for this episode. So really trying to hammer it home. Look, if I'm not doing the dirtly stuff, if I'm not doing the unearthed multicolor stuff, white is the place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle to get to 50 takes, folks. It was a 2-day effort. I got stuck at about 25 after the first day and then came back stronger the second day and got us all the way to 50. But you did a lot of refining. But yeah, I do think this is something that I am trying to hammer home in my brain as we end the format here.
Number 24, interacting was important enough that even something like Unleash Shell was totally playable. But you could say this about so many effects. Like, okay, both fight spells in green are good. Yep. Unleash Shell, good. Prison Sentence, one of the top commons in the format, according to 17 lands. Yep. Even Weakstone Subjugation. Yep. Here's my question for you, because I think we disagree here. Where did you land on the disenchant effects, which I guess are just disenchant and shoot down?
Disenchant main deck for me, shoot down, not great.
I was never really a fan of either of these. And honestly, I mean, I didn't like shoot down that much at all, but preferred shoot down to disenchant because of exile. Like the artifacts that I wanted to target, because so many of them were unearthed, I found that disenchant just didn't get the job done a lot of the time.
That's fair. And I do think worth noting, I don't know that we ever really said this over the course of the whole format, Prison Sentence is much better than disenchant.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, not even close.
That was kind of a question going in, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know us. We hate pacifism effects. And like a broken clock, it's going to be right twice a day. And sometimes pacifism will be better than disenchant, you know?
Yeah, I do think prison sentence and Weakstone subjugations were both just actually the G word. I think they were just good. And then Unleash Shell, playable. Not good, but playable. 5 mana for 5 damage was a necessary evil, I think.
And in the right decks, in the right shell, 2 to the face was 2 to the face was actually
the jokes in training, folks.
Sorry. 2 to the face was actually really important.
Number 25. You could go infinite with Staff of Domination plus Cradle Clear Cutter. Plus a way to pump its power like Giant Growth.
I never got to do this. The only times I ever saw Staff of Domination were in pack 3, and it was like too late to try and do the thing.
Yeah, I never did it either, but classically on brand, I had it done to me a couple of times.
But I guess what I heard was that on Arena, you couldn't actually go infinite because the rope would get you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the rope would get you.
Number 26, efficient combat tricks were very powerful in proactive decks. We've already sung the praises of Gaia's Gift, but I think worth shouting out Whirling Strike, which is the +2/+0 first strike trample trick, and Military Discipline as the 1 mana aura with flash that gave +1/+0 and first strike until end of turn.
Number 27, Clay Revenant was an important piece for a lot of engines.
Yeah, so I mean, I was still a fan of the blue uncommon Urza Looter. So that plus Clay Revenant, you could get yourself down to just a single black to make a Power Stone every turn and draw a card. Transmogrant Altar, though I did fall a little low on this card. You know, it came in very low. You like this card. Then week one, I was like, this card's awesome. And then slowly dipped down as the format went on, because I think Altar was just at the end of the day too slow. If we, again, to go back to this sort of unattainable description of why the format was fast, I can only point to certain anecdotes, and Altar feeling too slow is one of those. And I think my favorite of these was Fauna Shaman plus Clay Revenant, being able to repeatedly tutor for any creature in your deck.
Well, and Fauna Shaman was just amazing because most of the time you had a bomb rare to go get. Even if you didn't have a Clay Revenant, Fauna Shaman was a house in the format.
Well, and on Earth with Fauna Shaman felt so good.
Ooh, that too.
I got a shout out. But you didn't even talk about this in the What on Earth episode. We haven't talked about this yet. I got to shout out my favorite underrated card in the format, which is Disciples of Gix. This is a 4BB uncommon 4/4 that bins 3 artifacts when it comes into play. I absolutely love this card, and I cannot understand why it has such an abysmal win rate.
I could tell you that it's not a very good card. Would that convince you?
It is a 6-mana 4/4 that draws you 3 cards. You cannot convince me otherwise. The card is a beating.
It's so expensive. I literally never saw this card all format long.
Wow. I don't know what to tell you, buddy. But yeah, I think Clay Revenant was really a nice piece. And honestly, you rarely wanted it to hit the battlefield. The ideal scenario was it like bobbing back and forth between your graveyard and your hand.
Oh, absolutely.
Number 28, the Urzatron creatures were way more meme than dream.
Except in the LR versus LOL showdown, Taste It Marshall.
Yeah, you got to live the actual dream, which was Mine Worker on 2, Tower Worker on 3, Power Plant Worker on 4.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I do think Tower Worker was the best of the bunch. Would you agree?
They're all terrible.
I think Tower Worker was the only one that I would play outside of this sort of like, you know, terrible package of cards. But like, you know, in an Urza deck, I was happy to play like a Self-Assembler and a Tower Worker, for example.
Yeah, I would say Tower Worker is the most playable on its own. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, ramping from 3 to 5, 1/3 with reach, etc.
Number 29, your opponents will have removal and you need to plan accordingly.
Again, how many times can we shout out Gaia's Gift in this 50 takes, but such an important piece there. And I think that's true, right? This chain reaction of everyone has important cards, removal gets way better. And so because removal is being played by everybody as often as possible, protection spells are really premium, and they existed. Gaia's Gift and Lauren's Escape really gotcha.
Yeah. And then ways to rebuy as well, stuff like Recommission or Emergency Weld. All those type of cards went way up in value the better your cards were. So the more you have some Siege Veterans, the more you have those Skystrike Soldiers, the more you want these ways to rebuy them and find them and protect them.
However, number 30, Ashnod's Intervention is not a supernatural stamina variant.
Unplayable.
Yeah, this is the black +2/+0. Or does it even do +2/+0?
I don't know.
All right, never mind. Whatever. Unplayable. Moving on.
Number 31, Levitating Statue was the best build around uncommon in the format.
Boom, baby. Yeah, I think I'm in for this. This card was great.
This card was great. Best build around of the year it won.
That's true.
In our best and worst of 2022. How could it not be the best in the format?
Two critics raved. Best build around of the year.
But seriously, this was essentially colorless. I think if you built your deck right, could go in many different color pairs. And all you needed to do was get it to a 2-2. That was one non-creature spell before it was a real magic card. And then a 3-3, it's very good. So you didn't even have to go all in on it necessarily, but you also could just go super deep on it. And I think its best home was in a heavy blue deck with Falaji Archaeologists to help find it.
Yeah, I buy that for sure. Number 32, Over the Top and One with the Multiverse were great ways to meme later in the format. Over the Top? Say it ain't so.
Have you not cast that card?
No, it seems terrible to me. It seems terrible to even me.
No, that's so good. You make Power Stones, and then you have a bunch of permanents. It goes perfectly with Rectangle Theory. How have you not played this card?
I don't know. It just seems so bad to me.
No, you put just useless rectangles on the battlefield and then cast Over the Top, flip your deck over. And it's also one of the quickest ways to deck yourself to start doing loops with the stupid 2/5 that could put things on the bottom of your library. Loved Over the Top.
We'll be getting to the, quote, stupid 2/5 in just a few points, sir.
Number 33, moving onwards. Sentinel Stalwart plus Howling Mine literally lets you build your own personal Howling Mine.
Yeah, this was sweet. I hadn't even thought about this. And this is just way more dream than meme, right? Because once you saw Howling Mine, you go, okay, I'm going to grab a Sentinel Stalwart or more and going to be able to turn this on. And I got to do this once and it was awesome.
I did this several times. You could also do Howling Mine plus Mightstone's animation and start beating your opponent down with your Howling Mine. That was another cool way to do it.
Or Alloy Animist as well, an uncommon.
Yes.
Number 34, Rock Hunter has reach.
I attacked so many 2/2 levitating statues into Rock Hunter at the end of this format.
What are we going to do with you? When will we get the New Year's resolution of, I promise to read cards.
I'm going to play tighter. It's going to happen. 2023.
All right. We'll see.
It's definitely not. 35. Cantripping artifacts from the retro artifacts were very important to have as sacrifice fodder.
So we had Elsewhere Flask, Ichor Wellspring, Chromatic Star. Those are probably the best of the bunch because they cantripped on ETB or when sacrificed elsewhere in the case of Star. That was what made Star so good, was like you played it and then you could sacrifice it not just to itself, or you could sacrifice it to Strong Bull, sacrifice it to Junkyard Genius, and still get the benefit of drawing a card.
I thought that was actually the most annoying though, right? Because usually you want the card up front.
Yes, for sure. And I don't think Star was the best of those three. I think those three were the best of the bunch.
Yes, I agree.
Number 36, Soul Guide Lantern and Graveyard Hate in general was very strong. And I just remember being so impressed by Soul Guide Lantern. I was like, oh no, this is, what was it called? The 5-mana 3/4 that ate people's graveyards from Midnight Hunt. I was like, oh no, this is just a 1-mana version of that. Like, comes into play, snags an unearthed card, no fun for you. But that just pointed to how good Hating on Graveyards was in general.
Yeah, there was Unearth, there was all the Graveyard Recursion. Ashnod's Harvester also was such a backbreaking 2-drop when your opponent was on the play and you were doing some of the Unearth shenanigans with those self-mill creatures. Carrion Locust, like playable, the 2/1 flyer that nabbed a card on ETB. I mean, not good, but annoying when it hit.
For sure. I mean, one of the most frequently sideboarded in cards for me in Best of 3 if I wasn't main decking it.
Yeah, I'd buy that. Number 37. Keeper of the Cadence loops were hard to come by. There it is, the stupid 2/5.
There's the stupid 2/5. I mean, this card was spoiled. So Clay Revenant was spoiled. Ben was like, well, this is going to be Ethan's most drafted common. And then this card was spoiled and people were like, loops? And it was really hard because it couldn't put itself back. So usually with these kinds of effects, you're like, okay, once I grab two, they can like loop each other. But you couldn't do that because this could only put back artifacts, instants, and sorceries.
That's what Swift Gear Drake is for.
Yeah, but that's so awkward. Did you ever have to build like the worst loop engines of Swift Gear Drake plus Hoarding Recluse?
I never did Swift Gear Drake plus Recluse, but I had Swift Gear Drake alongside Keeper of the Cadence several times.
Yeah, I mean, but that's so awkward. How funny is that, that Swift Gear Drake, a 5-mana 2/4 flyer with haste, evasion, and haste, was only really playable for loops, for like the most dirtiest opposite of flying in haste possible.
I'm here for it.
Number 38, sacrifice outlets were very good in this format, thanks to lots of disposable rectangles being available. I mean, I'd say chief among them, Junkyard Genius, and then a dip, Transmogrant Altar, and then perhaps the most powerful, maybe? Penragon Strongbowl was wildly good.
Wildly good, but Junkyard Genius is significantly better than Strongbowl.
Yeah, I guess. But just like, you know, pound for pound, common versus uncommon.
Yes.
Strongbowl is very good. And then Thraxodemon, good, not great, as the two drop, just largely because three mana was a lot. And Killzone Acrobat, shockingly playable.
Yeah, I think fine. Like, if you didn't get the other sacrifice outlets, you were playing Killzone Acrobats. And it was best if you were doing the Steal and Sack thing, because that right. was a free way to play your sibling rivalry to, you know, steal the thing and then still have a sacrifice outlet on four mana. But mm-hmm. I think a dip down below the others.
Agreed.
Number 39, Sliced Bread was a recipe for success in Barrow.
So that is S for S tier.
L for lean.
I for interaction.
C for colorless.
E for engines.
D for drafting decks, not cards.
Boom, baby. Sliced Bread.
And we haven't talked about engines much. We've talked about speed of the format, but I do think it's important to note, if you're coming back to this format, or if you're coming to the format for the first time after listening to this episode, the format's fast, but if you adhere to the rules, the games can go pretty long, and then it's very important to have access to an engine to win the late game.
Number 40, Trench Stalker should wheel, but it is a house in the right deck. And the more I think about it, the more the right deck is just like a lot of black decks.
Well, yeah, there were self-contained ways to do this with Moment of Defiance. It was very good in black-red also. You had Bitter Reunions and the like in black-red. Blue-black, obviously right at home there when the deck wanted to draw two. But yeah, Trench Stalker was huge. I think point for you based on the crash course.
All right, sweet.
Number 41, Takesha's Amulet is the yin to Mishra Juggernaut's yang.
I'm so glad you're on board with this.
Yeah, I'm a believer. All it took was casting it once 6 weeks into the format.
It's just so big. Yeah. I mean, just so large, especially off the back of a Power Stone, casting this on turn four. And I think, you know, we're talking so much about our love for Amulet. Gotta give as much, if not more, love to Mishra's Juggernaut as just being so huge and then just Lava Axe in waiting in the graveyard.
Yeah. Scary card for sure.
Number 42, Incidental Life Gain was very good against the aggro decks in the format. So we're talking about, I'd say, the big three being Boulder Branch Golem, Obstinate Baloth, and Moment of Defiance.
This was my bread and butter in the first 2 weeks of the format. It just crushed everyone with black-green cards that affect the board.
And honestly, you can lump Trench Stalker in there. Like, all it took, it's so funny, like, all it took was Trench Stalker connecting once, right? It wasn't like you'd be like, all right, well, got to get a chain of draw two together so I can gain 4, 8, 12. It's like, no, you gain four life and have a 4/5 in play, you're stable, Mabel.
Well, it also Skyfisher Spider. I forgot that card gained life too.
Yeah.
What a card.
Yeah. Oh, and so sick. Like, when Skyfisher Spider goes to the graveyard and your opponent decides to not exile it, you're like, oh no. I guess Emergency Weld is getting cast next.
Yep, for sure. Number 43. As much as DMU taught you how to draft, Bro taught you how to build decks.
Yeah, I thought this was a really fun feature of the formats. Making cuts was super interesting in this set. Like, red-black is such a good example of you could build the deck many different ways, and you could fall into traps if you didn't recognize that you had, like, two halves of two different decks.
Yes, I think certainly possible to fall into that trap. And then stuff like Power Stone Fracture just ranged from either awesome, depending on how many disposable rectangles you had, to nearly unplayable, depending on the other cards surrounding it.
And I would say the more drafts you did, the more low power cards you found homes for. And that was fun for me. Like Wasteful Harvest, the two and a green card that milled five, and then you get to pick a card from among them and put it into your hand. You know, I didn't think that that card was very good, but I definitely found a few decks throughout the course of the format where I was happy with it in the deck. Number 44, Giant Cindermaw is a beating. I think you could just call this format also like stats the format in a way. Like, holy cow, 3-mana 4/3, large, trample, larger. Nerfing life gain was so real here too.
Yeah, this was insane when it came down on curve. And then also, like, it came down at a point where you sometimes had to double block it. Like, you had 2/2s, or you didn't have a 3/1. And double blocking this card was terrifying because there was so much good instant speed interaction and combat tricks and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a nightmare. But there were also times where, like, just on turn four, you were like, if I don't try and double block this now, I basically lose to it. So you were just, like, in this rock in a hard place.
Mm-hmm. Number 45, Mask of the Jade Crafter looks kind of clunky, but it is so many stats in one card and two artifacts in one card. Actually, four artifacts in one card.
There he goes. There he goes. He graduates from Rectangle Theory. Yeah, Mask of the Jade Crafter is incredibly powerful. And I think pretty underrated to this day. Like, in the sense of, I am thrilled to pack one, pick one this card. And I don't know if that's how the community at large feels.
Yeah, it feels like you steal something when you get it fourth pick because it's colorless.
Exactly. All right. Oh, I'm glad I get this point, Ben. Number 46, Lauren, Disciple of History, and Hulking Metamorph could let you go, in quotes, infinite. Little behind the scenes here. Before the show, Ben was going over the show notes. He goes, how does this let you go infinite? And I was like, do you want me to tell you now or do you want me to tell you on air? And he said, I couldn't care less. So I told him and he was like, are you the only person on earth that knows how to do this? So here's what this does, folks. You got Lauren, Disciple of History, comes into play. It says whenever it or another legendary creature comes into play, you return an artifact from your graveyard to your hand. Great. Then you cast Hulking Metamorph. Copy Lauren, Disciple of History. Oh no, legend rule. Oh wait, I know what I'm doing here. I'll keep the regular Lauren. I'll put Hulking Metamorph copy into the graveyard, but I get two triggers. So I return Hulking Metamorph and I return another artifact.
I never in my wildest dreams would have done something like that. So did you figure that out while you were drafting, or did you happen to have a deck with both of these cards and then realize when you had both of these cards?
Realize when I had both of the cards.
I literally would bet money that there are less than 100 people on planet Earth that know about that interaction.
And now I've shared this beauty with the masses.
There it is. I was thinking just like infinite sacrifice loops, and I was not impressed. And then you were like, two triggers, baby.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
I don't think legend ruling is not sacrificing.
Oh, what is it? State-based effects?
Yeah, I think it's just keep one. The other one goes away. I don't think it's sacrifice.
Number 47, build arounds that are closer to traps than real cards.
So sad.
Symmetry Matrix, Slagstone Refinery, Meticulous Excavation, Thran Vigil, Arms Race. Lots of dragons to slay in this format, but lots of dragons that were not very good.
Yeah, I have cast 4 out of 5 of these cards.
Ooh, I'm 2 for 5. I had some sweet Symmetry Matrix decks twice. I had Symmetry Matrix, and it was very good. And then I have tried unsuccessfully to make Meticulous Excavation a thing.
I got to play Arms Race with Portal to Phyrexia, and it was actually good.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, but I never got to do Thran Vigil. I think Thran Vigil is just like the slowest, clunkiest aura ever. So bad. Number 48, the three pillars of drafting the format were streamlined two-color decks, aggro decks, and unearth value. And I think a lot of variation among those three, but those were the three pillars.
Yeah, and I think you were looking for them in the order of unearth value, aggro decks, and then streamlined two-color.
I agree.
Number 49, because there are so many strong colorless cards, or essentially colorless cards with Unearth, you should try to stay open longer than normal in this format.
And I think I want to say exactly what you wrote here, which is longer than you feel comfortable. I think one of the biggest traps I saw people fall into was they understood that Unearth cards were colorless. And so their draft logs looked like, all right, I'm picking some colorless cards, I'm picking the Unearth cards, picking Energy Refractor, Evolving Wilds. And then, like, for some random reason, they got, like, a Conscripted Infantry pick 9. That's the 3-mana 3/1 that dies into a 1/1 in red. And then they would just decide that they're red. And I was like, you were delaying the decision so well. And then you just decided to latch onto a color for no reason and then pigeonholed yourself because you felt uncomfortable. So I think you got to live in that awkwardness a little bit longer than you want to.
Yeah, and then I think if you do live in that awkwardness, that gives you the option to get past some of those late gold uncommons and then move in on the streamlined two-color decks.
Exactly. Bringing us home here, number 50, Bro had very strict rules of engagement. Go back to Sliced, go back to Unearth being colorless, get it, go back to fastest format we've seen in a while. But if you follow those rules, you can win without rares, And I didn't even write this. You can even have fun.
I do think that is a boon for the format, is that there were lots of ways to have fun. And I do think it is more fun to do nonsense when it's difficult, right? Like, you're going to be under pressure. So it feels like more of an achievement to do fun things in a format like Bro than it does in a more mopey format where you have more time to set up your loops and your engine or whatever.
I agree, right? Like, you remember those games where you were scraping and clawing and you stabilized at one life and then turned it around. Like, those are, for me, the most fun games of Magic. And I think Bro allowed you to do that pretty well.
And I do think there was, with all of the rares, I'm going to put my two cents in here, I think there was a cost to doing business in this format. There were a number of games where your opponent played turn three Siege Veteran and it was over, or, you know, turn five Precursor Golem and it was over. But there's enough sweet stuff to do also that you get enough games where that doesn't happen that I do think it is net fun overall, for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Any parting thoughts about Bro?
I mean, Bro won the award for best format of 2022.
In your rankings,
according
to one of two Lords of Limited podcast co-hosts.
One out of every two doctors agree. I really like this format. I feel like I didn't give it its full lifetime, but I will be happy to return to it when it comes back as a flashback.
I think what happened to me was that I followed the rules very well for the first 3 weeks, and then I stopped following the rules because I was tired of following the rules. And then I was losing, and then I stopped having fun because I was losing because I wasn't following the rules. I wish I had a reason to come back to Bro right now, because I do feel, after recording these last two episodes on Bro, I feel kind of psyched to draft Bro, but I just am in such a good swing with Vintage Cube that I'm probably just going to keep Vintage Cubing the rest of the year.
Well, you'll at the very least have the event in the Arena Decathlon to sort of flex those muscles during.
Yeah, and I will probably do a few Bro drafts here and there, and I will make sure to follow the rules.
Excellent.
All right, great place to wrap us up. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
Thank you so much to TCG Player for sponsoring this podcast. If you're heading over there for any and all purchases or signing up for a TCG Player subscription to read all that sweet content on the CFB Pro side, please navigate your way there via our affiliate link at lordsoflimited.com/TCG Player to let them know we sent you over there. You can check us out streaming. I'm at twitch.tv/lord Tupperware. Ben is at twitch.tv/MrMetronome. We're both under those same usernames on Twitter, and you can tweet at the podcast at Lords of Limited.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.